I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Bill, how are you, mate?
How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. I don't know if you saw it, but the last message I sent you before the text today, I'd completely forgotten I'd sent it. In 2016, there's a picture of you and Josh and Aisha from the Kenniffs at a pub in Camden, and that must have been after you played at the...
Oh, wow, I totally remember that when we were hanging out. I completely remember that.
It was after, I think, Black Flag had played at the Underworld, and you'd come over and met us, like, literally straight after the show.
Oh, yeah, me and Josh and Aisha. Yeah.
Wild.
Nice. I just opened it back up. I mean, I saved it back then. I have it on my photo roll. Yeah, I really like them a lot. I still keep up with them. In fact, I talked to Josh just the other day. And Aisha, I talked to her about a month ago, I guess.
Nice. Well, she was doing some amazing stuff before live music and everything shut down. She was out on the road with Hans Zimmer, wasn't she?
Yeah. She and I both had a same day off in Vienna, Austria, a couple years ago when she was on that tour. And I was on tour with maybe Descendants or Flag. And so we hung out the whole day on our day off. Yeah. She told me all about it. What it's like to be touring on that big level like that. Because I never know, I don't know much about that.
I don't think many people do. That is like next level, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, good people they are. And so, Bill, that night would have been the first time I saw you play drums. And never in my life, I don't think before or since, have I seen anybody have as much fun as you seem to have on the drums. You looked like you were in your element. And when I saw you with Descendants last summer as well, when we nearly spoke then, again, just like a look of just absolute pure joy from start to end. Are you in a place, well, obviously at the moment, no, because of COVID and stuff, but forget about that for a minute. Before that, were you in a place where every show you play, you're just absolutely loving it and in your element?
I mean, it might sound kind of corny or cliche to say it, but yes, I don't know, a lot of things in the last couple of years have kind of turned around for me in a way that I'm just very happy most of the time, and also I just think I'm starting to just enjoy being up there playing in front of people, as opposed to most of my life I spent like having a lot of stage fright, and like a lot of nervousness, a lot of stage fright, a lot of insecurity, a lot of like sort of feeling as if I don't really deserve to be playing in front of people or something like that. I don't really know, but I just kind of worked it all out to where now I'm happy in that environment instead of it being more like some kind of struggle or some kind of competition. I guess it's hard to explain it. Could I pause 1 second? Just 1 second.
Of course, man. Yeah, of course.
Okay, yeah. Okay, I'm back. Sorry. Sorry about that.
No, don't be sorry at all. Give me a chance to brew my tea. Well, you actually, Bill, you sent me, when we were talking over email, you sent me an email and you said in that, you know, in your life, as much as on stage, you're the happiest you've ever been as well. Is that still true? Is that still the case, despite obviously the awful situation that's going on worldwide? Have you managed to hold on to your happiness and your positivity over the last sort of 6 to 8 months?
I have. If this stays how it is for another year, then I will be completely out of money and broke, and then I will be, you know, unhappy about that. But no, I've been thriving, actually. I've been using the time very productively. We produced the new Rise Against record. We've got two new Descendants records coming down the pike now. One kind of a current new material that we're working on now, and then another one that was from the original lineup from way, way, way back in the very beginning.
Amazing.
Kind of like our first songs we ever played together, but they never got recorded because we were so young and we didn't really know how to play back then. But we got together a while back and the original lineup, and we actually recorded all those old original songs in a real studio. So this year I've taken the time to get those all, get everything done on those, and Milo got the vocals done and we mixed it and everything. So, and then I've been mixing records, and I've been just keeping myself good. I've been on a real good nutrition thing and also exercising. So I would say I'm happier than I've ever been, but I'm probably healthier and stronger than I've been in about 20 years, I would say.
I'm really happy to hear that, Bill.
For my own comparative terms, you know, me compared to me, I feel really good, real healthy, real strong, and real happy.
Do you think, if you don't mind me asking this, because I had a fairly serious health scare myself about 7 years ago where I fractured my spine, and it was uncertain whether or not I would walk again. And when I was lying there in hospital, I was in hospital for 3 months, and that gives you a lot of time to think. And I think when you go through something that puts the nature and the meaning and the significance and the fragility and the beauty of life into perspective, I think if you come out of it, if you're lucky enough to come out of it, it gives you a whole new lease of life and gratitude. And do you think that was a part of it with you after the two things that you went through back to back? Do you think after that, that sort of reset you in a way that gave you a whole new focus and lust for life?
Yeah, those sorts of life events, they tend to do that. I had my huge pulmonary embolism in 2010, and also the brain surgery, the brain tumor in 2010. But then I also, in 2015, I had an open heart surgery and open lung surgery as well to remove that pulmonary embolism that it never resolved. So they had to go in and into my lungs and take it out. And also I had what's called a triple bypass, open heart surgery. And then in 2017, I had to have radiation on my brain because a little tiny bit of that brain tumor had grown up against my optic nerve and was starting to affect my vision. So it wasn't a brain surgery, but I had to have radiation every day for about a month and a half, and that really hurt me. I was really low energy, taking naps all the time and stuff, but I've bounced back from all that stuff, and I feel great. And I mean it sounds corny to say it, but yeah, I'm grateful to be alive. I'm grateful to be able to give my son a hug in the morning or to hang out with my daughter or whatever it is.
Yeah, I think that's what's been nice about lockdown as well. You have to look at the positives in this situation. And for me personally, I'm sure for you, and I know for a lot of other people that I know, one of the best things to come out of this period has been that time to really spend like condensed quality time with the people that you love. which, you know, when life is at its usual fast-paced kind of way, you don't have that same opportunity to really sit down and spend like days on end with the people, you know, that you care about and you love. And I think it's been great for that reason. Have you had a nice time being with your family? Have you had them around throughout the whole period?
Yeah, I really have. Unfortunately, we live in a large enough house to where we're here together and we can spend plenty of quality time with each other, but the house is large enough too to where you can escape. So even when it was winter and everything was locked down, we could also kind of have a little bit of space between each other. But yeah, I mean, on the more overtly positive side, I recorded things with my son playing guitar and singing. I recorded things with my daughter singing.
Amazing.
And I've been on a few like camping trips with my family and went backpacking twice with my son out into the mountains and in the wilderness. And so, yeah, I think it's been great, but you know, eventually I'll be broke.
Yeah.
You know, and then that
I hear
won't
that.
Be fun. That won't be fun, but for now it's okay.
It's cool you've been busy. So I had Tim from Rise Against on this show about 2 years ago now, Bill, and he spoke so highly about you and about not just your role as a producer in the evolution and the story of that band, but just as a human being and as a mentor and a friend in his life. And it was such a sweet conversation that I had, and he just was full of nothing but praise and compliments and complete adoration for you. And it sounds like you've got an amazing relationship with that band, and you've really been there with them over, you know, such an extended period of time now. Is this new album that you've just done, is this the sixth record that you've worked on with them?
It's been 19 years with them, and I honestly don't know how many albums. Let's call it six. That sounds about right.
It's a fair few though, isn't it?
We're all like family. I mean, our kids play with their kids, and my daughter Maddie used to babysit Tim's kids, and when they were here, and we do things together. We're all very, very, very close. And even now that they have Zach in the band, you know, I've been friends with Zach since he was in high school. Hagfish was one of the first bands we had at the Blasting Room at the recording studio, you know, 25 years ago. And that Zach was in the band Hagfish. And we're just all very close. Joe, the bass player, he's one of my very, very closest friends in the whole world. And Brandon and I have a great friendship too. Tim and I joke about it that it's possible that I've spent more time with him than I have with my own children.
they are kind of like your children, aren't they, Rise Against?
I just mean, well, I see them more as my comrades.
Yeah.
They're like family to us. Yeah. My wife and kids are very close with them too. It's just like, it's a big family. Yeah.
What made you move out to Colorado, Bill? Obviously, you grew up in kind of Los Angeles area. What was the allure and the pull of Colorado? Was it just the nature and the more wide open space?
Honestly, it was maybe not so romantic of an idea. It was almost more of a process of elimination, as boring as that sounds.
No.
So we felt like we weren't surviving in LA. We were sleeping in our practice room, which is the size of a garage, and with no hot water, no showers, and paying a lot of money. We were paying $1,200 a month for that practice room in LA. And we were just like, wow, we have to get out of here unless we want to just live like sardines for the rest of our lives. So we moved to the Midwest. We moved to Missouri for 4 years, where it was extremely low cost to live there. But then after we had been there a few years, we realized it was just too desolate. It was a town of only 4,000 people. and we were just kind of in the middle of nowhere. We felt like farmers or something. Not there's anything wrong with farmers, but I just mean it was a little bit too culturally devoid.
Yeah.
So we kind of struck on Fort Collins. It was a place we had been on tour and had had fun. We had a few friends here. We knew what it was like. We enjoyed it. And it's like, okay, LA is too big and too expensive, and Brookfield, Missouri is just too small. How about Fort Collins? How about middle ground, you know? And that's kind of that, honestly, that's how we made the decision.
Yeah, sometimes it's just the practical ones. And I guess it must have been nice being in Colorado over the last 6 months and having the chance. I found myself falling in love a lot more with, you know, these more kind of scenic countryside areas. I find that the city at the moment isn't the best place to be. I moved out of London about 3 months ago, and yeah, I think being in nature at the moment is the best place to be, getting out and about and amongst it.
I've always enjoyed it. I grew up at the beach, you know, in the Los Angeles area, Hermosa Beach. So it was always like swimming, fishing, surfing, boating, all that stuff. Mind you, I was the world's worst surfer. I would always fall off, but I just enjoyed all that stuff. I enjoy the smell of the ocean breeze and being on the boats and just being walking along the shoreline and all that. I love that. And I guess the mountains here and the rivers kind of, they offer a kind of a similar, I don't know, a relief from, I don't know, the grind.
Yeah, the pressures and the horrors in some cases of urban living. You mentioned Hermosa Beach there, Bill. Obviously, it's kind of common knowledge that you were an employee of Keith Morris's father in the fishing shop that he had there. Isn't it wild that so many of those bands that would go on to define that early Californian hardcore punk rock scene, you were basically all just neighbors, right? It was just like a small community of friends, and all the bands knew each other. And was that the way it was?
Yeah, I mean, if you localize it to just Black Flag, Pennywise, The Last, The Descendants, if you localize it to just those bands, that is all within a 2-square-mile radius. Everybody lived in, yeah. And everybody went to the same high school, but at different times, you know, like Pennywise went there after we did, and Black Flag went there before we did. Well, no, Fletcher was in, he was there when I was there. He was just, they were a little younger, you know, but yeah. But so yeah, all in that same area. And then if you expand a little broader to include the Minutemen and Saccharine Trust and, I'm drawing a blank right now, but then that's just down to like Long Beach and San Pedro and Gardena and Carson and stuff. So that's still a really small area.
And TSOL and bands like that, they were Long Beach, weren't they?
That was more Orange County, I do believe, like Huntington, Costa Mesa, I do believe.
As a young kid growing up, what was the importance of punk to you? Like, how did that culture, that music, that scene impact your life on a personal level in terms of how it changed your mindset and your interactions with other people and the world around you and everything, really? Was punk the light bulb moment for you?
It certainly was. It didn't start that way, because it started with me just trying to find something that could satisfy me, the kind of guitars I like, which you can hear them on mainly like on Black Sabbath records or some Kiss records or, you know, some Aerosmith records, like those kind of guitars. And I just couldn't find other music that had that for me. But then the Ramones, man, they had it, you know. The Ramones are like, you take Black Sabbath's Paranoid, but you supercharge it with a bunch of coffee. And then you got Ramones, and I was like, oh man. So I kind of fell in love with that, the music of it first. And then once I started going to the shows, Frank or some of the guys would drive, we'd get someone to drive us up to Hollywood, and we'd go, you could go see like for $5, you could see the Go-Go's, X, the weirdos, the screamers, the germs, like all at once, all of them for $5, stuff like that. And I, and it was like, there was only 100 people there or something. And I felt like, wow, wow, man, this is like so much energy here and so much, just, this is so different than anything I've ever seen. And it was like, then it just lit my life on fire. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that I had found this, this like hidden thing that not that many people knew about. It was so, so amazing to be part of that, or even just to witness it. And then, and I mean, to a certain extent, the Descendants are part of it, but we, you know, we were a little bit later than those first bands, but it was just so amazing. Such a wonderful energy.
Yeah, that initial LA punk scene with, I guess, the Germs and Fear and those kind of groups, like, what an exciting time for music and what an exciting time for LA as well. How old were you when you were going to those shows? Were you very much still like a teenager, a young kid?
14, 15. Yeah. And it was just, I mean, it blew my mind. I couldn't. And the other thing, too, is I didn't really have any good friends that I sort of cared about much. There was acquaintances at the beach or acquaintances fishing, but I really didn't have any friends. And once we started the band, it's like I felt like I finally had some close friends that could be sort of my brothers. And that, and then I felt like when I went to the punk shows, in the beginning it was definitely this way. I felt like I had a family. I had a whole family there. Once it got popular, the content of the audience kind of changed. It started out, it was more artists and freaks and people that didn't have anywhere to belong. But then once it got more popular, like maybe around the time that movie, The Decline of Western Civilization, came out, once it got more popular, then there were more like jocks and meatheads and kind of idiots got into it. But I mean, even still, then I felt like that pushed me out back out into the fringes, because I don't know, I just didn't feel as familial then. But in the beginning, man, it was so cool to be part of that.
Yeah, I think that's the beautiful thing about that. It's more than just a genre for me, and I had a very similar experience, and everybody that I've spoken to that comes from an even remotely punk background, it's always about that community for people, I think, isn't it? That aspect to it where you're looking for somewhere to just belong and be a part of a like-minded group of people that look out for each other. And it seems like that's what punk did for so many people. That's what it gave to so many people, you know, whether that was on the US or even here in the UK, that seems to me to be the kind of common thread. And I love that about punk.
Yeah. Punk rock saved me from being a lonely, miserable, probably would have become like an attorney or an accountant or something like that. Just, I have that kind of brain that could do those sorts of things. I just would have been miserable.
Did you get on well at school, Bill? Were you a good student? Did you get good grades, or were you not that?
Yes, I was.
Yeah.
Yes, I was. Yeah. I mean, I quit college halfway through because, like, I could have kept going to college and just been in the Descendants, and not, cause Descendants weren't really a touring band back then, but Black Flag kind of kept needing me.
Yeah. Well, that's a good position to be in, right?
So, yeah. So I started touring, and then I kind of never went back to college.
Well, talking of college, how do you and Milo first meet? Wasn't he a fan of Descendants before he was in the band? Is that right?
Yeah, it's funny. He would come to our practices, especially when we practiced at the church, the condemned church building, where because that was really close to all our houses. So I could just ride my bike to practice or walk. I could walk to practice, and Milo would just show up there and watch us practice. And then even when the church got like shut down and we had to start practicing down in Long Beach, then he would call me and ask me to come pick him up and bring him to practice. And he would just come to practice and sit there and watch us. And it was a funny thing. Frank and Tony really, they didn't want to continue to have to play and sing at the same time. And they were, and Milo secretly wanted to be our singer, but neither of us knew. Like, Milo didn't know that we wanted to have a singer, and we didn't know that Milo wanted to be our singer, but he was just always there. And I remember Frank one day, he just goes, "Fuck this, Milo, you sing." And that was it.
You say in the documentary that when Frank left the band, he just like poured all his belongings into like a bin of some kind, set it on fire, and drove off to Oregon. Is that right?
That is correct. That is absolutely correct. Frank had turned into quite the man of extremes. Yeah.
Talk about an exit.
Yeah.
I love it.
Ladies and gentlemen, good night.
That Milo Goes to College Records, I'm sure you get asked about it all the time, but I mean, there's a few albums in the history of punk and, well, all music, but in the case of punk, there's a few records that really stand out as just like the right record at the right time with the right songs, the right cover, just like capturing the zeitgeist of what was going on at that point in time. And Milo is definitely one of those albums. I wanted to ask you, Bill, when you're making an album like that, are you even remotely aware of what you're tapping into and how special what you're making is and how long it's going to last and continue to infect and inspire, or affect, I should say, and inspire people? Like, did you know you were onto something special at the time?
I would answer that with like a big, huge yes, but also an even bigger, huger no. And what I mean is, we were doing it completely for us, for ourselves only. We didn't even know, you know, what was involved in releasing a record. It was, you know, Mike Watt had just told us, "Hey, I can put your guys' records out if you record them." And so, you know, we would borrow money from my dad and go in and try to record. But I mean, the idea that more than like 200 people would ever hear it, that was not an idea that was in our head. We just thought, well, we're doing this because we love it. And that was it, you know. But that being said, we loved it so much. And in our little dumb, naive hearts, we thought that we were the best band in the whole world. And what we were doing was the coolest thing that anyone had ever done in the whole world. But that was just kind of like our little dream that we had. We never thought anyone would ever agree with us, or certainly we never thought that, you know, thousands of people would hear us and that kind of thing. Yeah. Never even crossed our mind. That's why even we do some of those early songs, like on the Fat EP, they're just like, okay, well, we're going to go get some fast food. Oh, let's make a song about how we get fast food. Oh, okay. I mean, it was only for us and our amusement.
Isn't it wild how, because for me, there's a massive leap sonically and in terms of just the arrangements and everything from the Fat EP to Milo Goes to College. And, you know, songs like My Age, Bike Age, Gene is Dead, Suburban Home, just so many great, great songs on there. Did you feel yourselves as songwriters making huge advancements and evolving really fast and just getting good? Did you feel that happening at the time as well? Or was that, again, you were just enjoying it and having fun?
Well, the chronology is a little bit convoluted. Fatty P was more like a side trip. We were playing, and I mean, we had all those songs, or most of them, that are on Milo Goes to College. We had all those when we recorded the Fat EP, but I don't know. When we recorded the Fat EP, it was weird. I was commercial fishing at the time and drinking all those crazy, those bonus cups, and Frank was taking speed, and because we had to fish all night, and it was like the Fat EP was this little moment in time where we were just playing as fast and as reckless as we could. And our buddy Pat told us to not have so many songs about girls. We should write a song about going to Wiener Schnitzel, and we should, you know, this kind of thing. And so it was, the Fat EP was like this little stopgap moment in time. But what we sounded like 6 months before the Fat EP and also 6 months after the Fat EP is Milo Goes to College. Like, Milo Goes to College is what we mainly sounded like.
When he said he was going to go off to college, was there any disappointment in the camp? Like, oh man, we've just made this amazing thing and now you're going to leave? Or were you always understanding of, you know, his desire to go and be that guy and do that as well as make music? Was it always like, this is the way it is and we accept it and understand it and that's totally cool? Or was it a little bit more difficult?
Yeah, we never really questioned the decision, because Milo is nothing if not a scientist. That is what he is, first and foremost. And so, it would be weird if he didn't pursue pursue the science. It would be strange if he did not do that. It would be unnatural.
It's lovely how supportive and just amazingly encouraging and sweet he is about all in the Descendants documentary. And he's like, you know, this is the most amazing stuff. Why don't more people appreciate this? And I think it's lovely that you've both managed to do exactly what you want in terms of your own respective lanes and careers, but then you get to come together as well and do Descendants. And I mean, after all these years, is Milo still one of your closest friends, and is that a friendship that, you know, you cherish and hold dear?
Milo is my best friend in the whole world. I value his friendship more than almost anything in the world, and he has been I might get a little sentimental here, but I'm just telling it like it is. He has been a better friend to me than I have to him. He has stuck by me through some just horrible phases of my life, changes of my personality, decisions that I've made, attitudes that I've taken, horrible bouts with sadness that I have had. He stuck with me through all of that and was nothing but loving and caring. And that's when we were young. But even recently, I had a bout with sadness, and I started kind of maybe drinking a bit too much, and I was just very sad all the time. And he wrote that beautiful song called Smile on the new record.
I love that song. That's a beautiful, beautiful song.
And that, I'm saying, you don't know. I mean, to have a friend like Milo, it just makes life worth living. That's all I could say about it. I love him more. I love him so much. There's no way I can even explain it. It has nothing to do with the band.
Yeah, that's amazing. I didn't know that song was about your friendship. Obviously, that's the beauty of a great song, isn't it? As I just assumed it was a love song about a girl and somebody singing about their partner. But, you know, I guess you guys are partners, aren't you? Your creative partners, your life partners, in a sense that you've spent the majority of your life creating and living and sharing experiences with each other. I didn't realize that song was about that. That's amazing. That's made me love it even more.
Oh man. He's the best friend anyone could ever want. That's it. I mean,
yeah, well, we all need a Milo in our life, don't we, Bill?
I certainly do. he has picked me up when I was disheveled and in pieces so many times, it is not even funny. I can't say that I've done the same for him, but maybe only once or twice, maybe two times in his life, I was kind of there to elevate him when he needed it. But it's mainly been the other way around, where he really bailed me out of a bad state of mind. He even wrote that song, Come Back Kid, you know. He wrote that like the day I got out of my brain surgery.
Well, what I loved in the documentary is when he's talking about, you know, you coming out of that health scare, and he was like, right, there's big bills mounting up for Bill. Better get the band back together and go out and play some shows. And again, what a beautiful move on his part. And I guess since then, it's made all of you appreciate, am I right in thinking that? It's made all of you appreciate playing together that much more?
Well, it certainly has with respect to Descendants and Milo. But, you know, the thing is, all never really stopped.
Yeah.
So, you know, Carl and Stefan and I, we just went and went and went and went and went. And with no real success, like, we were just still sleeping in our practice room. So I guess the happy ending is that we finally got to a point where we could make a living from the music, which, you know, that was never the case until 2010.
Carl and Stefan as well, with the last album, I noticed that a lot of the songs on there were written by those two, a lot of them. And
they always are, though. They always are.
There's just, I mean, when you've got four great songwriters in a band, you're in a pretty strong position, aren't you? I love that last record. So what's your expectations in terms of release for this one you're working on now? Do you hope to have that out next year?
Yeah, I think since touring isn't really a thing right now,
yeah,
we might kind of slip this Frank and Tony one out maybe a few months from now, because we can't really tour on it. Well, you know, Frank's deceased, and yeah. and you maybe, and then maybe have the new one, the new with the current lineup, maybe have that one, I don't know, eight 9 months from now, something like that. I'm really just guessing, because you know, the big holdup with the new one is I've become too critical of myself, and I can't seem to finish songs, or like I'm constantly changing them. It's like my OCD has finally got the best of me, and I can't be happy with anything that I do song wise so I just keep fussing over my songs. So the guys are like, come on, dude, get your songs. They've all got their songs. Well, Carl's still kind of getting some of his together, but I just sometimes I hate myself, you know.
Do you apply that kind of a approach to when you're producing other bands in terms of trying to refine and get the best song you're working towards? Or is it something you can only apply to yourself?
No, I totally apply it to producing. That's kind of the nature of the gig. But it might be the producing that has kind of ruined me. It's like nothing is ever good enough for me, and I kind of hate it.
Yeah, I guess it sounds like it becomes more like work than play, right? And you're not just lost in the moment having fun writing and jamming and...
Well, no, I mean, when I get lost in the moment, if I can get lost in the moment, those portions, because that's usually like I'll have one of those premonitions or dreams, kind of subconscious stuff, that'll usually be like a whole song chorus, lyrics, melody, chords, everything in my head, boom, like a finished record in my head, but only a chorus. Those things are pure because I know they're pure because they were subconscious. I didn't think about them. I didn't work for them. They just came. And those I don't second guess, because they came from the subconscious. Therefore, like, they are pure and they are real. But then say, okay, I got the chorus, now I got to get the verse. Well, what do I do? Write the verse? No, I can't write the verse. I have to wait for one of those things, those dreams, those things that I get. Those, like, they're not visions. I don't know what they are. I've never been able to explain it to anyone. But so I have to have, it's like they have to be those kind of songs, or else I think that they're false.
Where do you think creativity comes from, Bill? Do you think it is a form of magic, and it's something that is uncontrollable?
I do for me. I know there are people who can sit down with a guitar and kind of plink away at something and, hey, that sounds like a nice riff. Oh, okay, I'll write some lyrics. I've never done that once in my life, never. my thing's always, it's usually in the morning. As soon as I wake up, it's like, oh, shit, fuck, the song. Quick, write it down or quick, record it onto my phone. Like, I have zero control over it. I know, even as I say that, I know it sounds cheesy or like I'm making it up to make it seem mysterious. But no, I don't have any control over it, and I never have. It's just, the song is just kind of, it's almost like I'm just a conduit for the song to come out of the universe.
What about?
But sometimes I don't get the whole song. I just get the choruses. Sometimes I wish I could just put out only the part that came as a dream and not have the whole song. Like, okay, so here, I'll tell you. So you know the song Without Love?
Of course. That's my favorite song off the last album. I love it.
All right. So this is the story of Bill's songwriting. So I had like the premonition of Without Love, the chorus of it.
Yep.
In 2006.
Right.
And I sat on it going, well, okay, there's the chorus, but there's no verse and there's no bridge or anything. And I sat on it and I sat on it and I sat on it. And one day I said, well, fuck, this is like probably my best chorus I've ever written.
It's so good.
I can't let it go to waste. So I sent just the chorus all finished, guitars, bass, drums, vocals. I sent it to Stefan and I go, here you go, Stefan. This is just another one of my songs that's not ever going to get released. And he wrote music for verse and music for bridge. Cause I had the music for the intro. The music from the intro is like a variation on the music for the chorus. They're kind of similar. And so he wrote a verse and a bridge, just the music, you know, and he sent it back to me and I go, oh, okay. Now I sort of see what the song can be. And then I wrote the lyrics for the verses and the bridge. And then we had a song, but I would have never, ever finished it ever. And I have hundreds of songs like that.
Teamwork. That is, Bill, and thank God for it, because that is my favorite song on the last album. It's so good. That chorus is so huge. And what a frustrating position to be in, to have that and know that it's great, but not have the other parts to put it together.
I sat on it for 10 years.
That's amazing. Hey, listen, Bill, do you believe in God? Are you a spiritual person?
I don't believe in God, like some God. I guess I would say I'm very spiritual, but I believe in sort of, maybe I just think that what we call God, I think that's just the universe. And I guess if I had to say what I am, I'm maybe like a Buddhist, but without the Buddha.
You definitely think there's something going on, though. There's more to life than this. There's a higher power of some sort.
I don't know. I think there's energy, I guess I could say. And I don't know about more to life. I don't know about afterlife or any of that stuff. Obviously, nobody knows about that. But I just think there's not a God like the way, there's certainly not like Christ and God and all that shit. But there's, I feel like there's some kind of thing. I'm just going to call it the universe, energy.
When you're obviously in the positions that you've been in over the last few years dealing with these health things, do you get to thinking about life a lot and the nature of it and the meaning of it and why we're here and those kind of deep, heavy, unexplainable topics? Did you do much thinking about any of that?
But more is I've done a lot of just reading about it to try to learn more about different angles of it. I think one of the things that really helped me get to this kind of nice spot I'm sitting in right now is actually the book Siddhartha.
The book what? Sorry, what's it called?
Siddhartha.
Right. I'll have to check that out. I haven't read that.
And it's my favorite book ever. And I read it in high school, but I was obviously too young and immature to get anything out of it. That book, and then I read another book several years ago that had, just a a huge impact on me. It's a book by an author called Jed McKenna. The book is very sarcastically titled. It's called Spiritual Enlightenment, The Damnedest Thing. So it's like you can't let the title of the book fool you because it's kind of tongue-in-cheek.
Well, I think humor is such an important part of it all as well. Like as wise as we can try to be and strive to be, I think that a sense of humor and a sense of the absurd, I think that can get you through some of the weirdest and the strangest and the hardest times as well. Like for me, it's been such a key thing with my struggles in life when I've been going through hard times. And obviously, you know, a band like Descendants is a band that comedy and humor is such an integral part of that as well, isn't it? What's been the role of comedy and a sense of humor in your life, Bill, in terms of keeping you happy and sane?
I've always enjoyed comic relief, but it's easy for me to get too serious. I tend to get too serious. I just tend to. I don't like it in myself. I can sometimes be the, you know, the stick in the mud.
Yeah.
We have an expression, we call it a party pooper.
Yeah.
You know, like a Scrooge or a Grinch. I can sometimes be that way, but I sure try not to be. I try my best. I don't want to be that. But yeah, like those two books I mentioned, those probably had a bigger impact on me than anything in my life ever, other than, you know, having a family and, you know, wife and kids.
Wow.
Obviously that stuff is very life changing, but these two books had they affected me more than anything other than having a family and kids.
Well, I'm definitely going to check them out now then, if they've been that important to you. Bill, could we have a little trip down Black Flag Lane? Would you mind?
Sure.
I'd love to know, obviously you were kind of sharing a rehearsal space and that was sort of how the relationships there begin, but I'd love to know just the dynamic really and the personalities of yourself, Henry and Greg, when you're working on My War together, just the kind of, I don't know, the atmosphere and the mood and the relationships and the creation really of that album in 1984, and what sort of memories really come to mind when you think back to making that record with Henry and Greg and your relationship with those two guys at that point in time?
Well, when I was in Black Flag, I was straddling kind of between two identities. There was the identity, I had a certain kind of relationship with Henry. We had our things that we had in common. And then I had a certain kind of relationship with Greg, and we had our things that we had in common. But Henry, you know, Henry's a very humorous guy. He has a great sense of humor and a sharp wit. And a lot of times he and I would be joking around. We'd be joking around about something we heard or whatever. And then with Greg and I, it was a more serious relationship that was just strictly about music. Like we were on this never ending musical discussion. But then Henry and Greg, they didn't have a great relationship. So it wasn't like three best friends hanging out, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I was very close with Greg for many years, maybe 4 years, I guess. And I was very close with Henry for about 3 years. Because I knew Greg. Obviously, Henry came into our town, you know, later. So I had been close with Greg, you know, before already. But then at another side of it, that's kind of on the personal level. But then on the band member level, I was really just this dumb, naive kid that was, you know, how do you say, you know, just to be here?
Yeah, yeah.
And I, you know, I was, it's weird. I was maybe a little bit in awe or starstruck by the those guys, because even though, like, you know, that, I mean, Greg's parents' house and my parents' house, it's like 80 yards from each other.
Wow.
I mean, I was really in awe of Greg's talent. And then when Henry came too, I was really impressed with just the level of intensity that he brought into the band. He made the band very, very serious.
Yep.
And I was, you know, I was really impressed by all that. And I saw myself as maybe kind of a babe in the woods, kind of a, you know, that thing, Black Flag wasn't my band the way that with Descendants and all, I feel like I was, you know, I'm one of the founders, one of the main songwriters, one of the main contributors. Like we all are, it's our band. But with Black Flag, I mean, Black Flag was Greg's band. And like I just kind of lived in it.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It was a weird time for that band as well, obviously, because that record, I think, definitely polarized people, didn't it, at that time? And they were obviously experimenting and slowing things down, and they were definitely at a crossroads in their sound, and that's right when you came in. What was kind of the mood like when you're in the studio or on tour, indeed, with those dudes? Was it fun? Was it a good time? Or was it kind of tense and a bit fraught and, as you say, just hard music? So you just kind of getting in, smashing it out, and then getting out of there.
Well, there's one thing about My War that is that we had a very strange thing happen just right during the month before we recorded it, which is our practice place was in a pretty like mixed neighborhood in Long Beach. And I don't want to make this story too long, but basically our practice room, it kind of faced this park, a big park. And sometimes we'd just leave the door open and we practice so people in the park could hear if they wanted to come in and watch. We're trying to, I don't know, just promote an open thing. And we had a big show coming up. And so we had our poster on the door and we thought, hey, let's get some of these just random people from the park. Let's get them to come to the show. We'll put them on the guest list. And so we had this flyer on the door of our practice room, you know, and it said, you know, Black Flag, right? And so I don't know how this happened, but this supreme white power people thought that we were like a black movement, black people movement thing.
Right.
Because of the name, because of the name Black Flag. I mean, that's how stupid they are. They don't even know Black Flag is like the symbol for anarchy. But so they tried to kill us. I mean, they tried to run us over in their cars, and I don't mean a little bit. I mean, they came up onto the sidewalk, and me and Greg had to climb up onto this fence real quick, and then they drove by under us. And they kept saying that. They said SWP and then some number after it, like SWP 6734. And we found out later SWP means Supreme White Power. So they were trying to kill us. And then when we weren't at practice one day, they broke into the practice room and they stole a bunch of our shit. So for the last several practices that we did before we recorded My War, we did what I called armed practice. I had my fishing buddy, Pat, outside the practice room with a 30-30, with a fucking gun, so we could practice. And so I do think that added to the tenseness of the record in some small way, but not in a great way, but it seemed almost perfect fitting for such a just dark album, you know?
What an amazing story, Bill. I love that. That's an intense situation, isn't it?
Yeah, and then the night before we recorded, if my memory is serving me, me and Pat went down there in Mugger, I think, in the middle of the night and kind of cleared out all of our stuff and we just abandoned it and never went back there again because we were afraid for our lives. And it's really sad, though, because a lot of the black people and the Mexican people in the park, they would come by and listen to us. I mean, that we loved that area. We loved it because it was so diverse. And it wasn't just white punk rockers. It was all kinds of random people that didn't even know what punk rock was. But obviously our little utopian thing of having them all come to the show and we put it on the guest list, obviously the supreme white power people, they weren't ready for that.
That's wild. I mean, I guess there was a lot of violence and racism at that time as well. Like, as much as the scene was inclusive and punk was great for, you know, the minorities and fringe characters and freaks and weirdos, I guess as it became more popular, as you were alluding to earlier, it was a little bit infiltrated by these kind of neo-Nazi skinhead type thugs. How did they take
But just to be clear, this had nothing to do with the punk rock scene.
Yeah.
No one in that park even knew what punk rock was.
What I was going to say is kind of what was within the punk community when you had these kind of skinheads and stuff turning up to Black Flag shows, what was their reaction to Henry and indeed Henry to them? Was there any moments that were just like particularly powerful of the way he dealt with certain things on stage or incidences that went down or just him as a front man in the way that he commanded a crowd? And
well, starting in 83, we went to Europe in the late winter, early spring of 83. Starting then, I don't know what caused this, but we kept having to sort of fight the audience. I don't know why, but they would try to beat us up or they'd throw big chairs at us. I don't really know why. I don't see how that could be about hair length, but how stupid would that be? But I don't know. The Orthodox punkers at that point, they were pretty conservative. That's kind of what I mean. Like the 79 punk scene was more artists and weirdos. And there wasn't a lot of like floating around testosterone, but it changed. It changed starting in like 81. And yeah, by 83, there was a lot of, I don't know, man, this, a lot of weird conservative people, I guess. And so we'd end up getting beat up or we'd have to run out, you know, because I remember we in Stevenage, England, they were throwing the metal folding chairs up on the stage, and we just put our shit down and ran out the back door, and I jumped into a dumpster, a trash dumpster, because I didn't know what to do. I remember on that same tour, or no, this was in 1984, it was at Leeds, the Leeds Festival.
Yeah, yeah.
And I always take my traditional nap after soundcheck. I go in the van and I sleep after soundcheck. And I was waking up from my nap in the van to go in and find some coffee and get ready to play. And I step out of the van. I mean, I'm scratching my hair, scratching my balls, putting my pants belt on, pulling up my pants. And I start getting whipped with like a punker spiky belt by these guys. They're whipping me. And I was like, fuck, I'm not even awake yet. Could you let me wake up first before you do whatever you're trying to do? And I kind of just cowered away from them, hobbled away from them. But then it was around that time when I remember we got home from one of those tours. And Henry goes, Billy, meet me in the park tomorrow down in Hermosa Beach. Meet me in the park. We're going to start exercising. And I go, oh, yeah. I go, okay. And he goes, yeah. He goes, that shit's never going to happen again. And that's when Henry went from being this like kind of little scrawny dude to being all gnarly. We got really strong because he said the next time when we go back out on tour, the first person that comes up stage, I am going to knock them out, and no one is going to fuck with us while we're trying to play our music anymore. It's like all we wanted to do was play, but they wouldn't let us play. They would spit on us and try to burn. They would burn Henry's cigarettes and cut him and throw chairs at us So that sure enough, the next time we went on tour, I didn't even get through my drum roll thing on Nervous Breakdown. I didn't even get through the drum roll. Somebody came up and pushed Henry, and he just took him out. He knocked him out. And it's like, nope, this is our show, and we're not going to allow you guys to beat us up anymore. And then from then, I think people kind of quit bothering us so much because they knew we were going to defend ourselves.
That's wild. So you saw that transition firsthand, as you say, from the kind of more skinny, scrawny young kid to like, you know, that kind of ripped, tough man that he's now obviously known as being.
It hardened all of us. It hardened all of us. I don't know what I did. I think I grew a beard or something. I just wanted people to leave us alone.
Yeah, that makes sense. What about the music, Bill, from that time? Did you enjoy playing those kind of, you know, sort of free jazz noise jams that some of the, I mean, the Family Man record, there's some pretty wild stuff on there, the instrumental stuff. Did you have fun doing all that stuff? Was that a bit of you musically?
I did have fun with it, and I appreciate what it all was, and I really appreciate what we were sort of trying to do, to aspire to more than what we inherited musically.
Yeah.
And I believe in all that, but I can't say that a ton of it was real successful. There's some things I think were really successful, like Swingin' Man, I think is great. My War, the song is great. Nothing Left Inside is one of my favorite things I've ever been a part of. So I think it was hit and miss with those Family Man things. You know, we were listening to a lot of Mahavishnu Orchestra, obviously, and King Crimson. And it shows. Anybody that knows anything about music knows we're just ripping off King Crimson and Mahavishnu. Maybe a little Charlie Parker thrown in there. Maybe a little Ornette Coleman thrown in there, you know, certainly. But I don't know how successful those were, but it's kind of like I like the fact that we were doing it, but I'm not sure how well we did it.
Yeah. I guess as well, even like the Slip It In cover can't have helped. But, you know, I mean, those records are really interesting because there's obviously all the spoken word bits as well. And, you know, Henry's coming out with some pretty wild stuff in some of those.
Yeah. Yeah. In general, I think Family Man's a pretty cool record. I like the instrumental stuff okay, and I like the spoken stuff a lot. And I just like the context of it, of kind of taking a rock band and sort of dissecting it a little bit. And also, I like the kind of democratic nature of it, of like, well, we're doing this instrumental stuff, but we're a band. Well, where does that leave Henry? Well, let's do spoken stuff too. Like, you know, it seemed like the right thing at the time.
Are you still in touch with Henry or Greg? Were they relationships that would stay close over the years, or did you lose touch a little bit after you left the band?
Well, in Henry's case, yeah, Henry and I will email every once in a while. I think, you know, you drift apart over the years, but I mean, if I saw Henry, it would be all good times and we'd be joking around just like always. In the case of Greg, you know, Greg chose to alienate all of us, you know?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think I can speak for every person that has ever been in Black Flag. That none of us are friends with him anymore. No, but conversely, I am still friends with every single person that I've ever been in a band with. Every person, you know, Dez, Ron, even Robo. I love Robo. Everyone. You know, Doug from Descendants and Ray. Dave Smalley from All, Scott Reynolds, Chad Price. I'm friends with every single person I've ever been in a band with, except for Greg Ginn.
Why do you think it was that he went down that road, Bill, and did alienate everybody in the way that he did? What do you think it was that inspired him to do that?
You know, honestly, I can't speculate, and I don't really care to. It's just a sad thing.
Yeah,
because I considered him a friend at once, and it's just a sad thing. And I wouldn't want to start trying to analyze him, or you know, the next thing you know, he'd sue me or something. I honestly don't know what happened. I talked to the guys about it, and none of us really know what happened.
Is Keith Morris still a pal of yours?
I've known Keith since I was 8 fucking years old. You know what Keith is? He's my oldest friend. He's my longest friend.
Wow.
Yeah, no, Keith and I are very close. We played, what was it, last year? We played One Flag Show. That was fun. Yeah, no, we're all close. In fact, you know, Dez called me while I've been on the phone with you.
Oh, wow. But,
yeah, no, we're all very close. Yeah, we're all very close. And Chuck, who I was only a little bit close with Chuck when I was back in the Black Flag days, I'm really close to Chuck now. I consider Chuck to be one of my most cherished friends.
Yeah, he seems like a sweet guy. I've never met him, but in all the interviews that I've seen him doing, he seems like a sweet dude. I mean, all you guys do, really, to be honest. I think that's kind of, again, it goes back to that punk sense of community without over-romanticizing it. For me, it's, if you're in this thing for life, you know, unless you get super, super lucky like a Green Day and you strike out and you become a millionaire, I think most people who are in it for life are in it out of the love, right?
Yeah, and I with Chuck, I've grown closer and closer to him. I love him so much, and I'm just so envious of the way his mind works. He's just one of the smartest people I've ever met. I don't know, but I don't know a more graceful way of saying that.
What's left for you then, Bill? Is there anything you'd still like to do? You've obviously done so much and it's been an amazing story so far. Is there anything left on your list of either musical or just personal adventures or accomplishments that you'd still like to try and do? Or are you happy with everything you've done? Are you content?
I'm extremely content, but I do want to get these songs finished. It's like in my head, it's like it's like Cole Porter and the Germs all at the same time.
Wow.
But of course that, but of course you can't. Cole Porter and the Germs and Ornette Coleman and the Ramones all together. But of course that's impossible. But that, I want to get these songs finished. I think I'm going to do something really cool. I want to. I don't want, that's the thing. I don't really want to just do what I've already done. Play the surf beat, whatever. I mean, that's fine. But for live, like, I'm hoping I can write some songs that'll add a dimension to the live that isn't already there. You know, varying rhythms and varying beats. We play a long time. We play an hour and 15 minutes, hour and a half. I want to play more beats, more different kinds of rhythms during that time.
Yeah, that makes sense. You got to keep it interesting.
That'll make it even funner, you know?
Well, listen, Bill, I'm going to let you go. I want to say a big thank you for giving up your time. I've really, really enjoyed this.
Thank you. And I apologize for maybe having been difficult to reach or for seeming to be aloof or unavailable. It's a strictly a series of coincidences.
Not at all. No, I'm grateful for the time. And don't feel any need to apologize. I'm glad we got to do it. And I really look forward to, you know, whatever project you're in, whether it is Descendants, whether it's All, whether it's Flag, whatever's going on. I want to see you behind that kit again soon. And I hope I get to do it. I hope you get to do it as well. I hope we all get to do it. I mean, it's been a slow, long year, hasn't it? And I think everybody who is involved in music everywhere is itching to get back out and play. And hopefully we can all do that soon.
Yeah, it'll be fun. I got used to, you know, traveling so much all the time. I kind of have a, what do they call it? Wanderlust.
I think
I'll probably always have that. So yeah, I wouldn't mind doing some traveling next year, if plague permitting.
What is, just as the final question before we say goodbye, Bill, what has been the best thing about being you in your life? Being, what's the best thing about being Bill Stevenson today in 2020? What do you feel the most grateful for and appreciative of?
That I finally figured out how to be happy and not to be bitter and resentful and disgruntled all the time.
Love it. And what could you say to anybody who is struggling with that? What would be your piece of advice that you've learned?
Maybe read Siddhartha and then read that Jed McKenna book, The Spiritual Enlightenment, The Damnedest Thing.
Amazing.
I know that sounds stupid. Oh yeah, self-help book. Fuck that. I mean, but I'm just saying that's what helped me.
Well, listen, Bill, would you text me the names of them, and then I'll put them in the link to the episode when I get this podcast live. That would be good.
I sure will.
Lovely stuff. Bill, thanks so much again, man, and all the best. And I hope to see you in 2021 at a show somewhere. This has been great fun.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
And we'll talk soon, my friend. I'll get you a link and stuff when it's up. And yeah, thanks a lot again, Bill. Really, really enjoyed that.
Okay, see ya.
See ya, bud.
Another day goes by. We can't live like this anymore. Can't live without love. Our final chance to try. We can't live like this anymore. Can't live without love. Can't live without love. Can't live without love.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.